Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
All right, welcome to the latest edition to Hear That Podcast Growl. I'm Paul Inner Jr., Jay Morrison of The Athletic. We are always excited to be with you, as I say at the beginning of every show, but this week, this episode, we are 1 week away. We are 1 week away from our long national nightmare slash excitement to finally arrive. The draft is almost finally, for the love of all that is holy, here. So we're ready. We're ready to keep talking about it. We got two more episodes to keep talking about what could happen and what might happen and what if they and then should they and then what that guy and who, what about the seventh round? And we can finally talk about what happened. But Jay, we're not done yet. We're not done yet.
No, not by a long shot. And technically, in my mind, we're not a week away. We're 10 days away, because I see this massive project ending Saturday night around 8 o'clock, when we crack what you've dubbed the best beer of the year. That's when I really feel like it's time to exhale. Because, yes, once the draft starts, the hay is in the barn, so to speak, and you're just reporting on what happens. But it's still a busy 3 days with a lot going on. And I just look forward to that Saturday night when it is officially over for another 10 and a half months.
You know why I really am looking forward to the best beer of the year this year? Because as a fully vaccinated for almost a month now, beer drinking, bar going human, I can't wait to have that best beer of the year with some of my good friends on this beat.
Yeah, we high five everybody, hug everybody, lick every handrail.
Yeah, well, we can stop at hugs. We can stop at hugs. A lot I want to get to, though, today. The big thing we want to kind of parse through: Duke Tobin had his pre-draft news conference, which typically is full of non-answers and absolutely nothing. And there was a lot of that, but that doesn't mean we can't still parse through what was said. We can Zapruder film this audio here, okay? And I think we're going to do that on a couple of different topics. We want to talk a little bit about Duke Tobin's comments on the wide receiver position versus the offensive line position. I wonder why we would discuss that. And then we can also talk a little bit about on the concept of the trade back and some of the things that he said about trading back that I think we learned a little bit, maybe some, a little more insight into maybe what their strategy might be. We're going to talk about that. Also, discussion of Joe Burrow and Joe Burrow surfaces on the Chris Collinsworth. He rolled out on the Chris Collinsworth podcast over from PFF, talked a little bit about his rehab, expectations to play week one, talk a little bit about what he said there and what Duke Tobin said about those comments. Jay, you've participated in a beat writer mock draft that's going to come out. We looked at a Larry Holder in New Orleans has a great story on the best players of taking the actual reality of taking the best player available in a draft and what that actually would have looked like, and the ultimate draft round that Jeff Howe did. We've got all kinds of cool stuff, all these super statistical deep dives that are really fun to dive into. And Jay, in true form, you took a statistical deep dive and you statistically dove deeper. I'm proud of you for that.
I did. And it's going to be a sad dive for Bengals fans.
Well, so Jay's sad stats are back in full force. So we're excited to talk about that. The draft strategy series is complete. Yay. There's much rejoicing. So if you want to go back and peruse that, all parts are now up. And all links, the DBs is the last one, so you can go in there. There's links to every single one of the position groups, all the deep dives we did under those. man, it's pretty much an all you could possibly want look at the Bengals draft, the strategy, and what to anticipate from them, the names to watch, yada, yada, yada. So please, I hope you go check that out. Some new rules were passed. We know the schedule release is going to happen May 12th. Circle your calendars. We'll be talking about that day. The new rules, the new numbers are going to be in effect, where guys can, DBs and receivers and certain players can wear single digits now. That's very fun and exciting thing. No preseason overtime. Scribes rejoice. Yes. No preseason overtime anymore. Very exciting about that. So that's kind of some of the news that's going on. Another side note, I love to tease some of the other podcasts we have. The Athletic NFL podcast, Robert Mays, had Jay Gruden on, and they spent like the whole time talking about the early 2000 Bengals, including a great nugget about Giovanni Bernard coming on his pre-draft visit, and after he got back home from it, sent Mike Brown a handwritten note thanking him for bringing him in. How about that?
I mean, that's the way you win your way into Mike Brown's heart. Because Mike Brown
that's how you get drafted as the first running back in the draft, and spend 8 years with the team. So my final mock draft is coming Monday. So we'll keep an eye out that. We'll have that as part of the draft preview pod coming up. Whew! There is just a lot going on, Jay.
There is.
Okay, let's go into the language of Duke Tobin and talking about some of the things that he said. I want to start here because it's funny. These things they are normally just full of non-answers, and they usually go, actually, you know what? We'll just play it for you. These things normally go, this is our good friend of the program, friend of the show, Jeff Hobbs from Bengals.com, doing what we all try to do in these things, and that is get Duke Tobin to talk about something that we want to know about, that we're all talking about, and hoping that he will. And this is how it normally it always goes.
Hey Duke, how do you see the debate, the kind of a red hot debate out there? The tackle, you know, do you see the tackle as being a rarer spot than the wide receiver? It would seem like in Bengals history and through the league, the tackle, an elite tackle is rarer than an elite receiver.
Well, that's a pretty elegant way of asking a question that I'm not going to answer. I appreciate you. I appreciate you articulating it that way, but I don't intend to get into the debate about some of the very top level players in this draft. We're going through our rankings still. We're having meetings daily on it, and we'll come out with the order for our current team and for the long term of the Bengals. But I appreciate the question. But in terms of trying to rank some of the top names in the draft, based on position or otherwise, I'll probably avoid at this point.
I need to include that I was recording that off of my personal recorder next to my Zoom, not off the actual file that they send out, because it sounded clearer for me, so I was using that. But so you get the actual laugh reaction. Like, I think we all, if you look at all of our Zoom boxes, have the exact same reaction. But that's what it is. Like that is exactly the reaction that you expect. He kind of put it all on the table. Like, that's a very elegant way of trying to make me say something I'm not going to say, you know? And it's so, that is what you expect it to be. I do think there were some takeaways, though. Some things were kind of said, and involving the fifth overall pick. Let's start with, you know, Sewell versus Chase, right? Doesn't everything have to start there? So can we say hello to Mr. Chase? Yeah. So we have this whole concept of wide receiver versus offensive line, which is what Butch was trying to answer. And I just sort of asked the question about what's the toughest position in general besides quarterback to evaluate? That's the question here. And this is kind of the answer. This is a little bit of a couple of different questions of Duke talking about receivers and offensive linemen, and we'll talk about that.
Duke, what do you think in today's game is the toughest position to accurately predict success translating from college to pro? Maybe taking QB out, because obviously there's a lot there. But has that maybe changed over the last 5 to 10 years?
That's a good question. I don't have every position, you know, has certain traits that you'd like to see. And then every player has certain deficits that you have to say, okay, we'll accept that or we won't accept that. Very few players have all the traits you want and every measurable you want. But there isn't an easy position to say that's a definite translation. The biggest piece that we have is, you know, if you could tell me who was going to stay healthy, I would probably jump on that bandwagon immediately. So the health of these players is very difficult to predict, and the injuries that they will have in the future are very difficult to predict. In general, I think the game changes from college to the NFL. I think sometimes the size, strength, and physicality on the line of scrimmage is a big jump. And for some of the skill guys out there, I think maybe it's a little less of a jump because there are dynamic athletes that can run and move and cover in college as well. So, for the guys in the trenches, the strength, size, and physicality will all increase on our level.
Duke, what do you make of the growth of the receiver position the last few drafts specifically, and obviously over time we've seen how much you think these drafts with tons of quality receivers making an impact is just the way of life in the NFL going forward, or do you think it's maybe a thing where the pendulum will swing back and forth?
That's a good question. You know, colleges are throwing the ball an awful lot, and so they're developing these guys, and the NFL has become a passing league as well. So when you bring them in, you want to get use out of them right away. And I don't know that it's necessarily a new thing. When AJ came to us, his first year, we threw him right in, and he was a dynamic player for us. So especially with early round wideouts, you expect them to come in and contribute. That's why you take them. And I think the game translates a little more one-to-one, from the college game to the pro game there.
I think the thing that stands out to me here is essentially saying – wide receiver is an easier position to predict one-to-one on the next level. I think that was a general theme of this. And if you're applying it to this draft, that's relevant, right, Jay? I mean, that's an important nugget.
It is, and he's right. I mean, what they do, so much of what they do is in space. And, yeah, you're going to have press coverage, and you're going to have to break tackles once you catch the ball, but so much of what they do is on their own. It's what they can do physically, what they can do mentally. When you're talking about offensive tackles, even edge rushers, those guys in the trenches, I mean, you just don't know how their skills are going to transfer. Even if they're coming from the SEC or one of these elite college programs, you never really know how that's going to translate to going against grown men in the NFL every single play where your technique and your strength is being tested. So I would agree with that it's a lot easier to evaluate what a receiver is, but it hasn't actually played out that way. I mean, there rarely is the first receiver taken the one that turns out to be the best in that class. And you could probably say the same of offensive linemen, but I think if you're looking at it that way, that's just one more breadcrumb that they've left out there that they were probably leaning toward Chase as opposed to Sewell.
Yeah, I mean, it's all we're doing is trying to decipher what these crumbs are. Is this Toll House or is this Zesta? I'm not. What is that a saltine in there? Like this is where we're at, But I do think that the one thing that has kind of been typical of Duke Tobin in drafts and that has been part of the fabric of his strategy over the years has been hit doubles, right? Don't swing for the fences. He's not necessarily been a home run, the big risk reward guy. He's always kind of preferred, and that's not necessarily the safer pick. It's just a strategy of trying to draft solid players and a little bit of a belief in high floor. High floor is important at five, particularly because in general, the floor is pretty high. Opening yourself up to a chance of bust in the top 10 is something that can set you back, as the Bengals know, for a while. I mean, they reeled from the John Ross pick for a while there. And the idea of doing that again, I think, is scary. And that's where I think the chase thing comes into play here, because I think he's kind of saying, like, look, it's safer. The safer pick is Ja'Marr Chase. The safer pick is Ja'Marr Chase. And whether that's right or wrong, we can talk about what you believe in, and that's really what everybody's been yelling about forever. I think what Duke Tobin's saying here is the receiver, it's easier to understand exactly what you're getting with the receiver, specifically one that played with your quarterback. And that I think that's more than a morsel. That's more than a Zesta cracker crumb with a one piece of salt on it. I think that's like, you know, that's like a whole sandwich, in my opinion.
I thought Daniel Jeremiah had another media conference call yesterday, and he had a really interesting way of looking at it. Someone asked him about the Chase versus Sewell for the Bengals, and he said you can't just look at it in that vacuum of number five, that you have to look at it as a package. And what are they getting at five, and what are they getting at 38? And if you take Sewell first and then whatever receiver happens to be there at 38, is that a better package than taking Chase and whatever offensive lineman is going to be there? You have to feel better about getting a better offensive lineman at 38 than you would a wide receiver. Whether it's a lot better or a little better can be for debate, but that's where he kind of came down on that side too, of that he thinks the better package is Chase and then a good wide receiver, good offensive lineman in the second round, as opposed to Sewell, who may or may not be elite, and a good wide receiver in the second round.
I'm glad you said that. I want to bring up Bruce Feldman's piece, which is outstanding. He spent a month talking to different NFL coaches and evaluators throughout the league, just getting background on all of these guys and compiling it into essentially a draft confidential type of thing. But it's really good stuff. And there's a lot of relevant stuff for this conversation in there. And specifically, here's a little bit of the conversation about Ja'Marr Chase. I highly recommend you read the whole piece and subscribe and all that stuff. As you know, we've told you a million times all the great stuff that's out there, but you know, this is a part of it. Here's a quarterback coach. Says, I think it's not close among these receivers. Chase is way better than the rest of them, and it's a good class. He's like a much faster Anquan Boldin. I've heard that before. People say that. I think the idea that there's a tier that is Ja'Marr Chase, a tier that is Jalen Waddle and Devontae Smith, and then the tiers below them is an interesting thing that you don't hear often, but that kind of plays out here. Another person talking about, he's a grown man with this is a wide receiver coach. He's a grown man with the ball in his hands. He runs some out routes so smooth. He matches his lower body with his upper body, and that takes a long time. He's really able to drop his hits. I love Devontae Smith, but he's 31 pounds lighter than Chase. Wide receiver coach number two, Ja'Marr Chase is super competitive and so much stronger, so much more physical than the other top guys in this group. His pro day sealed it for me. I didn't think he would run as fast as he did, but he was smooth. He maximized that time off. A lot of these guys that opted out didn't. But he's definitely not a finished product. He doesn't get great job. Doesn't do a great job getting off press. He was playing X a lot. In this league, he ain't going to be able to muscle all these guys around like he did a lot of guys in the SEC. So a slight knock, but basically saying he is far and away the best. Let me bring you to the only thing I can find in here of anybody talking about offensive line and about Penei Sewell. You got to go all the way down, and it's kind of a throwaway in that Penei Sewell. I think Andrew Thomas, who the Giants took last year, was better. Jedrick Wills was too. Sewell does not have great length. He can play everywhere but center and might be able to do that too. I think he can be an elite guard, not a great tackle. That is from a scout on Sewell. And then another one on Rashawn Slater from a different scout. He has terrific feet. He's good with his hands. I think he's the most technically sound of the O-linemen. He doesn't have the same physicality as Sewell, but I think he's probably a safer pick and more polished at this point. Team Chase standing up, applauding, right?
Yes.
I mean, but, again, we said in this in the offensive line podcast, so much of this conversation is not about the position versus the position. It's the evaluation of Penei Sewell. And if he's not an elite prospect, if you don't have him in group 1A on your board, then yeah, then it's a moot point talking about the best path to building a great team. And I think that's where the argument for Team Chase comes from, is if you're getting a better player, period, end of discussion, if you take Chase at five.
The age-old adage, best player available. And the Bengals have needs at both positions. And, yeah, it looks like Chase is far and away, according to the wide receiver coach that was quoted in Bruce's article, he is a clear number one. Some people like Jalen Waddle, but in my mind, he's a clear number one. Not necessarily sure yet that Sewell is a clear number one. And even when you're comparing outside of the class, just best player, it just everything points to Chase. I expect, like, early on, I was waffling back and forth, and now the closer we get to the draft, I just get sure and sure and sure every day that it is going to be Chase. And Chase is who I took in the beat writer mock that'll be coming out tomorrow.
Yeah, and who I took in the final mock draft, spoiler alert, and have in every mock draft. The only time that I haven't taken Chase this entire run was when they made me pick the day before they signed Riley Reiff. I had to pick on Thursday, and they signed Reiff on Friday. So I picked Sewell because I was like, as of this minute. And that's how things, I think, it did change when they got Reiff, obviously. So, but it's felt that way the whole time, and that feeling, I think, has gotten stronger. We could be totally wrong. They could surprise us, and I'm positive that fans would take that well if it wasn't one of the big three that we speak of. What if? Could you imagine a card showing up with, like, Jalen Waddle at this point? I mean,
I would just applaud him. I mean, the we've talked about it, where there is a lot of smoke screening going on this time of year, and it just doesn't feel like that's the case with the Bengals this year because there's no need to. With it's probably going to be all quarterbacks in front of them. Who do they need to dupe? If they pull off a shocker like that, I will be upset that we've been wrong for so long, but I will also stand up and applaud them for fooling us for 3 months.
Yeah. Or us fooling ourselves.
Or that, which we've done many times.
All right, let's take a second and switch gears here and hear from a sponsor.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Let's talk about the other path that, you know, we go back to when we did the four paths, I thought was the best one, and that was the trade back. And I, you know, Duke sort of offered up a little bit more insight into what that looks like. I did enjoy, shout out James Rapine, taking a shot at, as Duke says, well, we're not going to get ourselves out of the run of a premier player. And James with a, well, so how many premier players are there in this draft? that's a good try. Probably won't spill what that number is. There is a line of demarcation, but here's what Duke Tobin had to say in a couple of different questions that revolved around trading back and decisions and what that premier player looks like.
Duke, have you received any intriguing offers for number five? I'm sure you've at least gotten some calls, but have you received at least any intriguing offers at five?
Yeah, there's nothing hard. I think people are still waiting to see exactly what's going to happen. Maybe at three and four, those things will come uh, little in a more firm way during the draft, as the draft unfolds. We have discussions with teams all the time about potentials and are you willing to talk about it? And yeah, we're willing to talk about it. It's got to be right. And I've said before, I don't anticipate going down to a point where we're losing the level of player that we're looking at right now. I think we're in a good spot. The way the talent is in this draft to get one of the guys that is a premier talent.
You kind of answered the second part that I was going to ask you. Is there a line of demarcation of how far you would be willing to go back?
I think so. It all depends on the compensation. But, again, I don't want to drop down a whole level of player, and we think there are some really top-level players that we're going to have access to right where we are.
Duke, a lot of debate at number five as we look at these mock drafts. Can you give us an idea if that debate was the same in your draft room with you and Mike and Zach and the Brain Trust, how that process works, and ultimately if there's a total disagreement, how you guys work it out?
Well, the position we're in right now, we're going to have a guy that everybody likes. And that's why I'm careful to get out of a position to where we're making those strong arguments where somebody is dead set against somebody. We're going to have a choice between people that we feel very strongly about. So that's a good position to be in. And we're just talking through what is the best way forward. And those discussions are ongoing, and they involve everybody that's had a hand in the evaluation. And I feel strongly we'll make the right call for us. But it's a call between really good options at different positions with different players, and you know, so that is a good position to be in. When you pick high in a draft, Gary, it's you pick a good player, but you leave a lot of good players on the board, and we're going to leave good players on the board. We get one pick. If we had multiple picks, we'd certainly use them, but. We feel like we'll take the right guy for us, and we'll get to that point sometime prior to draft day.
Jay, take a stab at what that number is and what that looks like. How far back is that?
I'd say 9. That's where the Broncos sit, right?
It is.
And they are a team that could need a quarterback. Probably do. I don't know how sold they are on Drew Lock. Would they come up that far if the first four are quarterbacks? You feel like there has to be at least two quarterbacks left for them to maybe make that leap. I think 9 is about as far back as you could go and still reasonably expect to get Slater. If they go further back than 9, that they're probably not getting Slater, Pitts, Sewell, or Chase. And then maybe you could say there's some elite players, but they wouldn't necessarily be at positions the Bengals are in need of. So that's where I would say the line of demarcation is 9.
Maybe 10. So there's like this conversation now around the Cowboys trying to come up for Pitts, right? Mm. I don't know how real that is. That feels more like a team that wants the best defensive player to slide to them. Trying to put something out about their love of Kyle Pitts. You better get in front of us if you want Pitts. but I, you know, to me, that would be an interesting thing if the Cowboys called about coming up to get Pitts, and you're taking, you know, you're adding one of their second round pick or whatever. You know, what's that? Are you still getting Waddle? Are you willing to go down the undersized receiver at the back of the top 10 again route?
Yeah.
Are you willing to do that? I mean, Waddle is extraordinary. He is fun, man. He is fun, and he's not John Ross. The physical tools of John Ross were not the problem necessarily. I mean, there's a lot of different things you can debate. We're not going to go down that wormhole, but Waddle is not John Ross. They are different players, you know. But if you're in that area, you're having that discussion, right? And is he, you know, I think as we go through the Feldman piece again, like there's a clear mark. Like who are you really getting? Are you going to get Slater? Are we going to talk about Vera Tucker in that realm now? You know, an elite guard. and maybe a tackle in the future, but an elite guard, right? If that's what you're believing. So is he considered part of the premier level that you would consider? And you could get him at 9 and 10. Now you're talking about you're taking guards in the top 10. I mean, potentially long term. So how do you feel about that? But I would be with you, Jay. I think it probably 9 would be at, would be the stretch of that range. I think they're pretty content to sit tight. I think if you read what, if you listen to what Duke's saying there, they just want to get a premier player. And as much as great as it would be, as willing as they would be to add that second round pick, and I'm sure they would like to, I don't think their premier player universe is that big.
No. And the other thing, I'm working on a story on the history of trading back out of those middle rounds. There's middle picks in the top 10 from 3 to 7. And the one word that kept coming up over and over again with people I talked to that have been in draft rooms and have done it is conviction. If you have conviction that there is an elite player that is far and above better than anyone you would get by moving back, you don't move back. Even if the compensation is great, you don't give up a chance to take a guy where you have this conviction that he is it. He is going to be the star everyone expects him to. And I think Ja'Marr Chase falls in that mold. And I just, again, the closer we get to the draft, I think it is more or less and less likely that we'll see them trade out. The second round feels more like that spot where the trade back, not just this year, but because they have a history of doing it at that spot.
I thought also the other interesting thing that Duke said was, you know, bringing up AJ Green, and this team does have they do like to rely on history and what they've done and how it's worked out in the building. And, you know, hey, we took AJ Green at the top and it worked out, you know, I mean, took AJ Green at 4 and it set off, you know, 5 straight playoff appearances. And in the year, this was actually part of the conversation with Jay Gruden and Robert Mays that I loved. And in the year, they knew they needed a receiver and a quarterback. They knew they had 2 major needs, and the other one was quarterback. Forget offensive line, it was quarterback. And they pushed it off because they believed in the receiver. And it worked, right? I know Bengals fans are listening. It didn't work. It didn't work. They didn't win a playoff game. I know. They won a lot of games. I'm not going to go. We're also not going to relitigate the playoff failures of 11 to 15. But having AJ Green worked, and Andy Dalton, getting him at that level was one of the best value second round picks that there's been in a long time. So putting off the bigger need for the great receiver, this has literally played itself out 10 years ago. And they have loved the outcome.
Yeah, and you go back and look at 2011, that there was a thinner gap between the best and second best wide receiver in that class. You could argue that they're flipped, but Julio Jones was sitting there too, and they could have believed that maybe if we move back 2-3 spots, we still have a shot at Julio. And they were that sold on AJ Green that they turned down all offers to move up. And I don't think that gap is near as thin this year. It feels like Chase has quite a bit of separation on Waddle and Devontae Smith.
And, you know, the other element of this that Duke brought up was the injury element and the inability to predict that. Mm-hmm. But what has turned into just a consistent run of first round picks getting hurt. Bengals fans would need to be reminded of that. But, you know, what is the safer pick in terms of injury? You know, in terms of an injury potentially happening. Both, if you're talking about Sewell and Chase, both are very well built for their position. Neither have any real injury history. Both opted out. But still, I think it's even on that range. But that's when you get into the other guys, Waddle and Smith. I think the nuggets that Duke was dropping about, look, I don't, you know, that's part of the equation. What's the chance of a guy gets injured? When you talk about those two guys, I mean, Smith showing up at 166 pounds is, you can love everything you want to about him, but I mean, you're nervous the guy's going to get hurt. And And I think that's part of the differentiator here. I don't think that does much for Sewell versus Chase, but I do think it does something for some of the other guys that are in the mix.
Yeah, one of my favorite quotes from a former GM I was talking to about for some of these draft stories was projecting longevity for players. And, you know, can you? Is it a total crapshoot? Is there anything in their makeup or that you can, you know, kind of see them being a long-term guy? And he said, little guys get hurt. End of story. Little guys get hurt. And that's, I mean, that there again, that's one more reason that Chase is bigger and sturdier. And it's just, it's not a guarantee, but you almost have to look at it as an inevitability that a little guy is going to get hurt at some point. And then it comes down to, can he come back from it?
Yep. Jay, you mentioned the second round trade thing. You have that in the beat writer mock draft that's coming out. What was your takeaway from what you ended up? Well, first of all, what did you end up doing? And what was some of the most interesting parts about the trade back you made in the second round? That will be out soon. I don't know when.
Tomorrow.
Any of these things tomorrow. Okay.
Yeah.
But so little preview for you here. Jay, you trade back in the second round. What happened there?
Yeah. All right. First of all, it's a 2-round mock. So the fruits of my labor on the trade back will never be known in this article, but
fool.
it was interesting because I would have considered it anyhow, I think, but the way this mock played out, Texas offensive lineman Samuel Cosme, Landon Dickerson and Alex Leatherwood were all gone in the first round. And those were, you know, the ones you kind of think might be in play for the Bengals at 38.
This is all beat writers. So this is all
insiders. These are
all
beat writers.
This is all our insiders.
Yeah. And not only that, we talked about how this isn't really a top-heavy edge rusher class. 5 edge rushers were off the board before the Bengals picked at 38. So, and I had taken Chase in the first round. So I threw it out there asking if anybody wanted to trade up. The Chargers jumped immediately, and they offered to move up from 47 to 38 and give me their 4th-round pick, which was – I can't remember the number. But I countered and asked if they would give me their 3rd-round pick, and then I would throw back the Bengals' 4th-round pick, and they took it. So what it ended up being was 38 and 111 to the Chargers – for 47 and for 47 and 77. And I love this, the way this worked out, because I was thinking 78, and then he reminded me that technically the Patriots had 77 and the Chargers had 78, but the Patriots had to forfeit 77 for spying on the Bengals in the Cleveland press box. So it's the Chargers. So I got the 77 pick. So I traded down 9 spots, and I'm thinking, I thought 38 was too early to take Liam Eichenberg. I could have taken Carlos Basham, but I thought offensive lineman was the way they needed to go in the second round. And I thought there was a good chance Eichenberg would still be there at 47. He wasn't. He went 2 picks later. Joe Person from the Panthers took him. So, and then Basham went as well. So it got down to 47, and the best offensive lineman in my mind at that point was Jalen Mayfield from Michigan, who has tackle guard versatility. They need an upgrade at both. He could be the first guy off the bench this year, maybe win a starting guard spot. So it doesn't look great on the surface, Jamar Chase and Jalen Mayfield, but then you consider that the Bengals are now going to have 2 picks fairly early in the 3rd round, and they've got that chance to do the double up at offensive line. Maybe a Dylan Raddins if he goes. We'll never know because we're not going to get to the 3rd round of this exercise. and then get an edge rusher too. So it just felt right to make that trade back, not only with the way things played out in this mock, but looking at the Bengals' history.
Yep, 2017 to 2019, the Bengals traded back in the second round in all of those drafts. And then last year, we know they fielded calls all day. And we're actually hoping to trade back, but loved T. Higgins as a value too much. They never actually pulled the trigger. But I think that was more a statement on T. Higgins and less on the fact that their desire to trade back was there. So they love to do it. They love to pay it off. They love to pay it off with extra picks. I wonder, Jay, if I was asking Duke Tobin those two scenarios, if he would take just the straight extra pick at 111 or want the move up, just because getting the extra pick often is more of where the value is rather than just the move up. But they've done both. You know, when they the Sam Hubbard, Malik Jefferson draft, they moved up for the position, and in a couple of the other drafts, they moved back just to add the fourth round pick. But I would not, I think that is a move that people should be talking more about. That's very realistic. That could happen. And there's nothing wrong with Jalen Mayfield. I think Jalen Mayfield comes in as your starting guard.
Yeah.
Week one probably, and you know that's kind of the type of guy that you're talking about getting. Let's get into the Burrow thing real quick before we kind of start to wrap this up. Joe Burrow went on the Chris Collinsworth podcast on PFF. First time he has talked since just after the season. And essentially he says, as far as his rehab goes, they talked about a lot of stuff, but as far as his rehab goes, says, I'm very optimistic about where I'm at and also where the team is at. I'm expecting to play game one. I expect to take part in practice. I'm feeling really good. Basically, all signs point to week one. He's optimistic. So we asked, I believe, Tyler Dragon of the Cincinnati Inquirer asked Duke Tobin about Joe Burrow saying this, and here is what Duke Tobin had to say about that.
Speaking of injuries, your quarterback said that he's still optimistic about playing week one. Are you optimistic that he'll be available for the season opener, and how is his rehab going, your estimation?
Yeah, I'm with Joe. If he's optimistic, I'm optimistic. That's Joe, and that's our expectation too. And I haven't been close to the rehab. I've been grinding away in the draft room, but when I've seen him, I've been impressed with where he is and how he's working, and what he says, I believe, and that's certainly our expectation too. He checks the boxes for a motivated player and one that loves the competition and loves competing and will do what it takes to put himself in that position.
One last question.
Speaking of Joe, how much is he lobbying for Ja'Marr Chase? Is he?
I haven't heard a lobby. Again, I've been head down in my draft room. Joe is aware of the players that we have in front of us. I think he's on board with anybody we choose, from that group. And there is no active lobby for any one or the other. I do think he is aware of the universe and is on board with anybody we choose from that universe. And that's a good thing. I've said it before, we're going to do what we think is best to make Joe as successful as he can be. Because the more successful Joe is, the more successful the Bengals will be. But the expectation is always to win. And that's his expectation. That's mine. And it'd be everybody's in the organization. And so we'll take the guy that we'll think will help us achieve that.
So that's Duke Tobin talking about Joe Burrow and being optimistic. And I don't think that, this is not different than anything that we haven't talked through the grind of the draft. We've kind of been more like Duke here. We've kind of had our head in the sand in the draft coverage, and we haven't been doing the daily updates on the Burrow rehab because everything has seemed to be going to plan. Everybody's been comfortable with what's been happening there, and you're still so far out. You have to use words like optimistic and expectation and things like that because it's just as much as you want to pinpoint dates, you can never really know for sure until you start getting close. But things look good. Things look good. They're on the right track. Everybody's happy with where he's at. They've put him on a pace to be week one from the beginning. And I think the thought is that that's going to be very attainable. And so this kind of backs up a lot of kind of what the thought has been, that no big deal. Everybody's happy with where it's going.
Yeah, I don't have this data, but it would be interesting to see if players do suffer setbacks in ACL rehab, if it comes earlier rather than later, because I'm trying to do the math in my head right now. And I think we have either just crossed or we are right at the halfway point If you look at the date of the injury and the date of the opener, I mean, we're about, what, 5 months and a week or two since the injury, and we're about 4 months and 2 weeks from the start of the season. So it feels to me like he's over the hump of that halfway hump. Now, I don't know where those setbacks typically come, but you have to be feeling good if you get to that halfway point and you've not only not had any setbacks, but you feel good about the progress and you feel optimistic. I think that's just kind of Joe anyhow. He's a headstrong, confident guy, and it makes sense that he would say nothing other than, yes, I'm optimistic, I'll be ready. But I think it is a good sign that we either have reached or are about to reach that halfway threshold.
You know, he's dropping back, he's throwing, he's not rolling out yet, but he's doing everything else you would do in a normal throwing session, throwing to trainers and stuff, and some of the receivers are there. So, but that's kind of where that stands, and not lobbying for anybody, supposedly. But I'm sure, but it definitely being asked for information, but not lobbying. He's aware of the universe, but not lobbying. So
I'm sure. Well, and Duke said they listened to what players say about their former teammates that are being drafted. So of course you're going to ask Joe Burrow about some insight to Ja'Marr Chase. And of course, Joe Burrow is going to say, yeah, get that guy. He's great. I mean, I almost wonder how Duke talked about how valuable that process is, because it's perspective they wouldn't otherwise get. But really, how many guys are going to say, oh no, don't draft that guy? If you played with a guy, not only played with a guy, but went undefeated and won a national championship, you're probably going to vouch for him coming and joining you as a teammate.
Yeah. The only, you know, you can get insight into somebody who maybe wasn't always the best teammate, but played really well. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you're right. I doubt that that's going to be the case when you talk about Chase. All right, let's just take a quick break. Jay, you've got some sad stats. Let's make the people sad. We had a lot of happy talk here, you know, about things people are saying and looking forward to the draft. So let's bring everybody down a little bit, okay? You've got some sad stats on the ultimate draft round, right? Is that the one where you've got the saddest stats?
Yeah, kudos to Jeff Howe for putting this together. I thought it was really interesting. I thought it was a great idea for a story. What he did is he looked at who was the best draft pick ever at each draft spot, 1 through 32. And there's no Bengals on the list. And there could have been. The only one that was in consideration was Anthony Munoz at number 3, one of the best number 3 overall picks of all time. But Jeff went with Barry Sanders, and you know, kind of hard to disagree with that. But what I wanted to do was look at who the Bengals took instead of these best overall picks. And wow, some of them are going to make you shake your head. The one right off the bat, the Bengals, the first six, the Bengals never had a chance to take any of the top six. Peyton Manning at 1, Lawrence Taylor at 2, Barry Sanders at 3, Walter Payton at 4, Deion Sanders 5, Walter Jones 6. The Bengals picked later than those in each of those years. In 1999, the Bengals picked 3rd and took Akili Smith.
Why has it got to be 99?
And Champ Bailey went number 7 overall, and he is the best number 7 pick of all time, according to Jeff Howe. There's a couple repeat incidents on here. if you talk about bad first-round picks or ones that didn't work out, maybe Akili goes in the bad one. This one goes into the one that just didn't work out. Injury, Kajana Carter, 1995, number 1 overall. Warren Sapp went later in that draft at number 12, the best number 12 pick of all time. Ty Law went 23rd, the best number 23 pick of all time. And Derek Brooks went 28, the best number 28 pick of all time. Bengals could have had any one of those guys. And then another one that really stands out is Randy Moss, best number 21 pick of all time. The Bengals had 2 shots at him. They took Takiyo Spikes at 13 and Brian Simmons at 17, a pair of linebackers. They're not the ones where they missed out on these guys. They're not all bad. In 1983, Dan Marino, best number 27 pick of all time. The Bengals took center Dave Remington 25th. I mean, Ken Anderson was still in his prime. They weren't going to draft Dan Marino. That one you just kind of say, yeah, it happened. Same in 1996, Ray Lewis, the best number 26 pick of all time. The Bengals took Willie Anderson. Borderline Hall of Famer, You know, it's just a different position. The only time, and this may be one of the worst ones on the list, the only time that the Bengals took a player at the same position before the best pick of all time was 1985. They took Eddie Brown 13th, and Jerry Rice went three picks later at 16. That one still has to sting a little. And Eddie Brown had a terrific career, but knowing you had a shot at Jerry Rice, yeah, that's a bad miss.
And then to lose to Jerry in the Super Bowl.
Yes, twice. No, once. Once. He wasn't there in the first one.
Yes. What, who wins that Super Bowl if Jerry Rice and Eddie Brown are on different teams?
Right. And another one we talked about earlier, A.J. Green.
That's so sad. This really took a turn. Hey, let's talk about the 99 draft. Let's talk about losing the Super Bowl, huh? What else you got, Jay?
Well, let's talk about
Dave Shula a little bit and Ketchana Carter.
a case where this really kind of – it's hard to judge. Cameron Hayward, the best number 31 pick of all time, came in 2011. The Bengals picked fourth that year and took A.J. Green. No one, I don't think, is going to say we would rather have Cameron Hayward than A.J. Green.
No. The Munoz versus Sanders thing is a fun conversation it for is. The middle of the offseason when we've got nothing else to talk about. I could have fun with that. That's a good one. Did you have anything on the how many times a team actually took the best player available? Or is that the big?
Well, the most interesting thing is the Bengals only did it once. Since 1985.
Actually took the best player available.
Took the best player available. You could probably guess Geno in the fourth round. And they've done it six times in their history. Most were in the early to mid-70s. Boomer in 84. And then before that, that's when you go back and the other ones were those early to mid-70s. The Bengals, six in their history. The Baltimore Ravens also have six, and they didn't come around until nearly 30 years after the Bengals. So it kind of shows you the difference there in the front offices. And it was an interesting way he did it. It was basically if you used a approximate value by Pro Football Reference, and you can debate how relevant that metric is. But if a player had a higher approximate value, late in the draft, say in the sixth round, it wiped out everybody before that. I mean, you could have had a great first round pick, but if he didn't have as high of an approximate value as someone taken in the sixth round, well, then you didn't take the best player available. Neither did anybody else in rounds 2, 3, 4, or 5. So it was an interesting way for him to do it. Crazy props to Larry Holder, because that had to have been a long, arduous exercise, but it's a really interesting read to go back through and look at the players and the numbers and where those best players available were taken.
Yeah. Ton of great stuff up on the site right now. By the way, all the breakdown of everything that happened with the Super League in soccer is fascinating, and The Athletic with all the inside stories on that. It's been fun to read all that stuff too. Everything going on with the Reds and UC, and of course our draft coverage across the league is out of control right now with so much stuff, and next week we will have even more. Jay, you've mentioned a couple of stories you've got coming next week that are going to be great. So I'm really, really looking forward to all of that. So, and then on Monday, we'll be back with our full draft preview podcast. We'll be all in to set the table for the week finally being here, us finally talking about the actual draft and the countdown to the best beer of the year. That's what it's all about. All right. Thanks, everybody, for listening. We will talk to you next time. Have a good one, everybody.
Hey, football fans, this is Diana Rossini from The Athletic. Get the top stories in pro football snapped directly to your inbox with our latest NFL newsletter, Scoop City. Jacob Robinson and I will bring you the daily scoop of top NFL articles, posts, and podcasts every Monday to Friday. Sign up for free now at theathletic.com/scoop.